So Terry implored me to give you folks problems rather than solutions. And so I'll start with what I consider one of the main problems and the things that interest me, which is the fact that for the genomes which we're getting sequences of, we only know a little bit of data about the proteins from experiments. That actually, for most proteins, for most genomes, the fraction of genes which have been experimentally studied is vanishingly small. For a lot of them, it's none. For a handful of interesting pathogens, it's just a few genes. Even for the best studied model organisms like Drosophila, it's only about 20-30% of the genes. Drosophila was almost exactly 20% of the genes that had been experimentally characterized prior to sequencing the genome. And moreover, that tiny fraction of 20% isn't even a good survey of the biology of those organisms in the same way one, for example, the star survey, since tries to figure out what the universe is like by looking at some well-sampled section of the universe. Instead, these are proteins which have been studied because they were of particular interest at some particular time, and therefore represent the biases of what people thought was important biology at that time. And so, for example, when the Drosophila genome was sequenced, they found that all of the cell signaling proteins and known pathways were amongst those which had already been found before. Most of the nuclear steroid receptors were amongst those which were in those that had been seen before. And so the remainder of the biology organism is probably has a lot of biology there, which is qualitatively different from what we've seen experimentally thus far. And so as you've heard through all the talks that have occurred so far, that most of what we know about the functions of genes in completely sequenced genomes and how they operate comes through computational methods. And I'm not going to go into these because you've heard about most of these types of methods using sequence analysis, hidden Markov models, correlative type approaches, and phylogeny to interpret function. But I do want to just make one thing explicit, which I find often a lot of biologists don't even have explicit in their minds. And so even though I'm sure you've heard this before, I just want to repeat it, which is that the way we get at function by homology is first looking for sequence similarity, if you're starting with sequence. And from that sequence similarity, you then try to make an inference of evolutionary relationships between a protein from a newly sequenced genome and a protein from a genome that has been that's been experimentally characterized. And so that's the first thing you do, is you try to actually make an inference of evolution relationships. So this is an inference rather than a measurement, whereas this is a measurement you make using some sort of algorithm. And then from this evolutionary relationship, then you can almost always infer structural similarity, because protein structure is better conserved than a sequence. And so if you've inferred homology, you basically can be more or less guaranteed to make an inference of structural similarity of the two proteins. And what you try to do is make the inference of functional similarity. And it's based on these types of functional similarities that people make annotations of completely sequenced genomes. And for microbes, people are often able to annotate up to around 75% of the genome. For more complex organisms, the functional annotation ends up being considerably poorer. But how accurate is this actual genome annotation? And so here's my next problem I'm going to present to you. Well, I want to point out that the quality of the sequencing itself is typically very well known. People know to a high degree how accurate the sequence they're generating is. And people have some idea about the quality of the gene predictions they're making. They don't actually get typically very good gene predictions, but they at least know how good they are. And as you heard from Chris Burge, he gave a lot of statistics about how good the gene predictions were. Whereas functional accuracy has been much more fuzzy. The only place I could find anyone claim a functional accuracy measure was of 99.5% in one of the papers by Chris Sander, but this was not tested experimentally. In fact, there was no evidence at all for where this number came from. This was in a paper that was about a method called GeneQuiz in their annotation of the Mycoplasma genitalium genome. And the key thing is that we rely on these functional assignments for the biological interpretation. So the biology, which we presumably ultimately want to understand, hinges on the accuracy of these functional annotations, which have really never been quantitated in the literature by anyone who's making it.
Can you not explain how do you arrive at 99.5%?
In fact, I'm not even confident they even gave that number in the paper. I think it may have just been on their website. And I could not find any evidence whatsoever for where this number came from. And so one thing that I decided we could do was to look at annotations made by groups. And where there was one genome that had been annotated by different groups, we could see where the annotations were compatible or not compatible. Now, this won't really tell us everything we want to know, because the methods being applied by the different groups are highly correlated with each other. Not only are they highly correlated with each other, but they're using the same sort of sequence analysis methods, they're searching the same sorts of databases, but also the annotation happened sequentially. It was first Tiger, who actually sequenced the genome, made an annotation. Then the GeneQuiz group led by Chris Sander made an annotation and published those results, saying our results are much better than the Tiger annotation, and the Tiger annotation was junk, essentially. Then NCBI made an annotation saying the GeneQuiz annotation was junk, and that was Eugene Koonin at NCBI and his collaborators. And then after that, the folks in Sanders' group whom they run GeneQuiz actually did a second annotation again. And the original annotation, which is what they went to, went to their publication, has been lost. They claim they no longer have it, and so it's not possible to use that data. And so what we can look at are the original annotation by Tiger, the re-annotation by NCBI, Eugene Koonin and his colleagues, and the current annotation by this GeneQuiz method. I should tell you also that a lot of the GeneQuiz recent annotations actually just basically copied over annotations made by either of these two, and so I just ignored those in those cases, where they copied it explicitly by saying what he said. And what you find is you're trying to understand where groups have agreed or disagreed in their annotations. That's actually hard to do, because you've got genes like this one here, MG463, where one group, Tiger, calls it high-level cascomycin resistance gene, which tells you something about what its phenotype is. That's basically provides antibiotic resistance. Whereas NCBI described it as molecular function, saying that it's a methyltransferase. And GeneQuiz agreed with them. But it turns out that actually the methyltransferase and the antibiotic resistance are the same function, just different levels of description of the same function, so these are all compatible. Then there are cases like MG10, where two groups just called it a DNA primase, and then the third group, NCBI, called it a DNA primase, but they had two caveats. One is they said it's a paralog, that's what the P here indicates. The second thing they did was they said it was a truncated version. So they're kind of hinting and waving their hands that maybe this isn't really a normal DNA primase, or that its particular role within the cell might be different. But still, benefit of the doubt, they'll call them all compatible. This third gene here, MG225, the Tiger group called this a hypothetical protein, meaning they just didn't know what it was, and so I just ignore those from the case because they haven't gotten it wrong or right. And what was fascinating is that NCBI and GeneQuiz, when they did their analysis, they both found database matches to the same protein, which was a histidine permease. The GeneQuiz group, which uses a fully automated approach, simply said the highest hit is a histidine permease, therefore the function of this gene is histidine permease, and that's what they put down. Eugene Koonin, looking at the histidine permease, said it's not a really, really great hit to this other protein, and since I know that permeases change their specificity rapidly over evolutionary time, I mean, if a more general sort of umbrella function, which is amino acid permease, it may be this protein's actually histidine permease, or maybe it's some other sort of permease for another amino acid, or maybe it transports multiple amino acids. And so I'll give it this more general term, it's kind of hedging his bets. And so these two are compatible because if it is a histidine permease, then they're both right. But it's also possible that it would be an amino acid permease and not a histidine permease. Even when you try to give the groups the benefit of the doubt, you still find cases which you really can't reconcile. Here's a case of where one group calls it a permease, the other group calls it a ribosomal protein. While it's conceivable that there are permeases that are ribosomal proteins, it seemed improbable to me, and so I colored in differently. Given that the bacteria being annotated doesn't have mitochondria, this seemed like a particularly unfortunate annotation, and so it gave me some additional confidence that the two were actually differing in what their functions were. Here's a case which actually was harder for me, and this I could be wrong about. I haven't found anyone who's disagreed with me yet. These two both describe it as a pilin repressor, and NCBI described it as a chaperone-like protein. Conceivably, a pilin repressor could be a chaperone-like protein, but I couldn't find any evidence of that. Then there was actually three cases in the genome where all three groups disagree on what the function is. It turns out that all these functions are different enzymatic functions. When you look at the picture for the whole genome, it looks like this, where each three horizontal dots corresponds to the annotations from the three groups for one gene, so the 468 genes annotated in this original version of the MG genome. And so, for example, we have the white circles, those correspond to basically no annotations, so those are just more or less ignored, where you have different colors, that means that they're conflicting annotations. And so here's one of the cases where there are three different annotations. Here's a group, an annotation where two groups agreed and one group had something different. This is the ribosomal protein cluster, which fortunately everyone annotated correctly, or at least everyone agreed on its annotation. When you... Right, so these white... Right, so these white circles here, where they're actually, you can't see it clearly, but they're actually ringed with blue, and what that indicates is that this is the cases where the GeneQuiz annotation basically just copied over directly annotation that one of the other groups had made. And essentially what had happened is when GeneQuiz redid their analysis, by that point many of these genes from the genome were already in the databases they were searching. So they said the function of gene MG465 is the function of gene MG465 from the database. And so there was really no annotation they'd done other than doing an identity match. And so I just ignored those and considered those as no annotation at all. And so that's what all this white here in the third column typically represents. Cases like this are cases where a gene quiz actually made an annotation, the other two did not make an annotation. Here's a group, a gene where none of the three groups made an annotation of the function. Right, and that's because a large fraction of the genes had gone into GenBank by that point, into SwissProt by that point, and consequently they were just copying over the SwissProt annotation for the identical gene. I expect that probably if we had done this analysis with the original gene quiz annotation, then they obviously wouldn't have any white circles in the last column, which were these white ringed with blue circles in the last column, and probably there would actually be more conflicts as a consequence. So when you average all this across the whole genome, you find that the average error rate must be at least 8%. That if you only count a conflict as giving the least number of errors, then there's at least an 8% error rate. My guess, based on looking at this, and no real data really, but just from observing what's happened, is that the actual error rate is probably 2 to 3 times higher. And my basis for that is the high correlation between what groups are doing, the likelihood that they've copied over errors from the database, and that the gene quiz group seems to have basically made fewer errors because it was copying data from the database other groups had done. So where do these errors come from? First thing is from poor sequence comparison, where groups have done a sequence database search, they found a match, and it wasn't really a significant match, but they claimed that they called it significant. And this is something which today probably shouldn't happen anymore because of the statistics for database searching. One shouldn't go and make false matches if one's doing the searching carefully and trying to use good parameters. This is the second thing, which is probably the hardest thing, which is the incorrect inferences of function from homology, that actually the database search was done okay, they found a match that was homologous, but the functions of the genes had diverged since their evolutionary ancestor. And what Eugene Koonin has proposed as the biggest source of error is actually propagation of erroneous data, because all of these errors here are going into the databases, like SwissProt and especially GenBank, and then someone can do another database search, and even if they find a match to a protein which has the same function as their protein, and the annotator is having the same function as the thing in the database, they may still get their annotation wrong because the thing in the database was annotated wrong. And so the errors in databases are growing, and probably they're on the order of 8 to 20% in SwissProt today, depending upon who you ask. And so even if you did everything correct in your annotation, as long as you're relying on the database, you're still going to be in trouble. And so Eugene Koonin actually claims this is currently the biggest problem. So these are problems that we have. These are proposed for solutions. This problem here can be largely solved today, I think, by careful sequence comparison. It doesn't solve your problem of false negatives, but should largely eliminate the false positives. The avoidance of over-annotation is something to which there is no simple solution right now. How do you actually avoid over-annotating function based on the homology? The complete description of the method in the database. So actually, when you put something into the database, describe how it is you found that match, whether you actually did an experiment, whether you did a computational database search, how you made the inference of function from that database search. And then this big black box of new methods for functional characterization, which I think probably be talked about more later on in the program. And so we have a picture which looks like this, where we have some proteins are experimentally studied, some where you function by homology, and hopefully these will get better over time, but they're still problematic. There's a high error rate amongst these. And then there's a large fraction of every genome which are just mysteries. For the human genome, it was about half of the genome. Basically, it didn't have homologous matches to anything of particular interest that was known before and well characterized. For bacterial genomes, it's about a quarter of the genome on average. So what do we do about these mysteries? Well, there's no actual experimental way you can go after one of these genes and say, was it due? So even if you're willing to do the experiments, you wouldn't be able, there's no experiment you can do to actually ask, what is the function of a gene? It's an ill-posed question, which biology doesn't really have a way of addressing. You can make a knockout, and I'll give you an organism which either looks normal, looks dead, or looks leaky. And so you really can't derive that much in general unless you have some good hypothesis as to what the gene is doing. And so people talk about making large-scale screens, but I think that they're going to be very limited in what they can tell us. And the approach that we've been trying to pursue, and I want to suggest to you as a way of trying to look at those mysteries, is by going beyond the one-dimensional world we normally live in of analyzing sequences, where we have DNA to RNA via transcription and then to protein via translation, thinking instead in the three-dimensional world of the structures of these molecules, and in particular thinking about the structures of the proteins. So here we have, for example, polymerase, the ribosome, and some particular protein structure. The reason for this is that protein structure is comprehensible in a way that protein sequence isn't. The model I'm showing you here is actually a model of the alpha helix that was made by that was made before there had been recognized experimental evidence that existed. It was based on the prediction by Pauling that this particular structure would exist. Crick built this model, and then they used this model to find out what layer lines they expected to find in the electron density they had collected from proteins previously. And then later on, they actually found that it did match what they'd found in this model. So this model actually predated the experimental data, whereas no one's been able to hypothesize a sequence which would have a particular protein function. And so the structure is comprehensible in a way the sequence is not. And as all of you know, after the alpha helix was predicted to exist, the beta sheet was predicted to exist, but it was unclear based on these very elegant units of secondary structure how they would form real proteins. I mean, you could, for example, take the alpha helix and extend it infinitely and you get in a line, but it was known that a lot of proteins were soluble and globular. And it turns out that real proteins do exist sometimes in really long proteins. For example, collagen basically is lots of really long helices bound up in a three-helix bundle. And this is a transmembrane protein, which actually follows very much the model some people had of early protein structure, where you have lots of helices basically just packed against each other in a parallel sort of way. But most proteins aren't transmembrane proteins. Most proteins aren't these huge extended helices. And similarly, for beta sheets, if you think of them as a plane, effectively, the only way you can really deal with them is extending the plane out infinitely or stacking these planes on top of each other. And that does also happen in real proteins, but typically in proteins like the prion protein that causes mad cow disease, and not in the soluble globular proteins that account for most of the proteins in the cell. And so real structures of proteins only became apparent from experiment. And this is the structure of myoglobin solved by Kendrew and colleagues. And what was evident in the structure was that it did have the elegant units of secondary structure, such as these tubes here, each were the alpha helices, which had been predicted by Pauling, and he was extremely excited about finding that the protein structure was almost entirely made of the helices that he predicted. But the overall structure was basically a catastrophe. They have no idea what to make of this weird, writhing structure, which looked unlike anything they'd ever imagined. They had no concept that the structure could look anything like this. They had no idea how the protein came in to have this fold. They had no idea how to interpret this. It was therefore incredibly fortunate that the second structure solved was that of hemoglobin. And what they were able to recognize, even in this very low-resolution structure solved by Perutz and his colleagues, was that each of the four subunits, 1, 2, 3, and 4, there's one down here in the shadow, had the same unexpected and unusual structure as did the myoglobin. And they knew that the hemoglobin and the myoglobin also were similar in their function, they both carried oxygen. And so you maybe see it a little clearer here in this structure. So this is the myoglobin, this is hemoglobin with one subunit highlighted. They had extremely similar structures. And from the similarity in the structure and the similarity in the function, they made the inference that these two proteins must be evolutionarily related. And that's an inference they actually made and published in their very first paper about this molecule. And they assumed because these proteins were so obviously clearly evolutionarily related, that therefore they have very similar sequences. But they didn't have the sequences at the time that they solved the structures. And those became available a few years later in 1961. But what they did was they took the sequences of the proteins, once they had them, and aligned them based on the structures that they'd had formed previously. And to their astonishment, the sequences were less similar than were the structures. In fact, the sequences had far more non-identical positions than they did identical positions, that they'd evolved very, very far in their sequences. In fact, until around the mid-90s, you would not have been able to recognize these two proteins as being homologous to each other using the typical type of sequence analysis methods that most people employed. Percentage identity methods of trying to recognize homology would never detect these two proteins as being evolutionarily related to each other. And as I'll talk about in a moment, it turns out that this is a general feature, that most evolutionary relationships cannot be found from sequence, but can be found from structure, that structure is a far better conserved, and therefore a far more efficient way of finding evolutionary relationships. So for years, the number of structures has grown dramatically. This has been good because it means that we've had more proteins which we can understand at a molecular level. We can understand exactly how they're operating and be able to find distant evolutionary relationships not detectable from sequence. But it's grown to be so great that actually no one can keep track of all of it, that it actually grown beyond the ability for people to understand all the information that was there. And so to try to understand that, my colleagues and I in Cambridge, England, built a database called SCOP. And actually, Alexei Mirzin is the key person who is responsible for maintaining the SCOP database, along with Cyrus Chiotia, Laura Ladonna Locante, and Tim Hubbard. And what the SCOP database does, it takes all the proteins of known structure which are in the protein data bank, chops them into their constituent domains, because domains are the fundamental units of protein structure and protein evolution, and then classifies each of those domains at several different levels. The first key level it does is first, you can see here, for example, it says 1CDG, 1 to 382. That, yes?
Is it obvious how to chop them into domains?
Not really, actually. That's a really good question. Why don't I actually go on to the next slide? It'll be more clear what I mean by domains for anyone who's not entirely familiar with it. So this is a cyclodextrin glycosyl transferase from a Bacillus organism. And it has two domains. There's one domain which is a beta alpha barrel, which is the one which I've highlighted here. And there's another domain which is kind of this orangey color in the background. And for the SCALP database, what we do is we divide these into domains based on visual inspection. And the intent is to identify domains based on what you look like compact units of protein structure, but in particular, compact units of protein structure which appear to have evolved independently in evolution. That either we've seen them on their own, for example, we've seen this particular type of structure here that's highlighted on its own in evolution, or where you've seen it in a different context. So, for example, where instead of having this orange thing back here, we have something with a different shape that's associated with it. And so really we use an evolutionary approach in SCALP to trying to define those domains. And while it's not always obvious, in most cases it's pretty clear. And probably in most cases, I'd say 90% of the time, 90% of people would agree on what a domain definition is. There definitely are some hard cases where people disagree on domain definitions. And part of that comes from the fact that there are probably about a half dozen different ways of defining domains in protein structure. And all of them are really, in some way, very different where they're coming from. We use an evolutionary basis. Other people will look for a compact unit of structure. Other people will look for hydrophobic core. Other people will look for something which experimentally ends up being something that can fold on its own. And actually, the amazing thing is that given all these different types of definitions of domains, that they usually converge on the same sort of thing. And so, no, it's not obvious how to define domains. That we use a method, basically visual inspection, with a particular basis of trying to look at evolutionary relationships. And that there are other approaches, but normally most people will agree on what the domains are.
How common is it following the amino acid chain, starting with a domain, another domain, and then come back?
So I can't
so
get...
The domain is actually two separate parts.
So I can't give you numbers on that right now, although I could later this afternoon. All that data is there. I can't give an unbiased number for that because there are a very large number of single domain proteins in the protein data bank, and so those obviously have to be contiguous. Of the multi-domain proteins, it's a significant fraction that are discontiguous. I mean, it's probably on the order of, this is a really rough guess, a quarter of them are discontiguous that way. It's a sizable fraction. And I can give you the exact numbers later, that those numbers are easy to get. And so we take that domain that I had highlighted there, and actually that was from Bacillus circulans. And it turns out that there's another protein which is exactly identical in sequence to it also in the database, 1CGT, probably solved under different conditions. And so we join this together saying these are the same protein from the same species. It turns out the same protein's also been solved from another species, Bacillus stearothermophilus. And so we join those together at what we call the protein level. And then using database searches, the sequence comparison methods that you would use on any sequences, ignoring the structure altogether, we group these together with other proteins into the same family. So for example, these proteins, the cyclodextrin glycosyl transferases, are sequenced similar to the alcid alpha amylases, the oligo 1,6 glucosidases, and so these are in the alpha amylase N-terminal domain family. And so at this point, up to the family level through here, basically, all the classification is the same stuff that you could do without using any of the structural data, other than the fact that we have the domain definitions, which do require the structural information. It's for the information above here that we critically use the structure information. And so the first level above the family is what's known as the superfamily level. The superfamily level joins together families which are dissimilar in sequence or would not be readily found using sequence comparison methods, but which we believe are homologous because of their similarity in structure. And so, for example, the N-terminal domain alpha amylases and the third domain beta galactosidases are grouped together into the glycosyl transferase superfamily. But a key thing to recognize is that not all proteins with the same structure are necessarily evolutionarily related to each other. So the decision to put all of these into the same superfamily is not simply saying these proteins have the same overall structure, but it's also explicitly saying that there are special features of those proteins, either which we know functionally or which we know from looking at the structure in detail, which give us confidence that these proteins are evolutionarily related. And typically what's involved is looking for other characteristics of the protein which are in some way independent of the overall structure. For example, seeing that they have the same residues in their active site with the same configuration. That would give us confidence that the proteins have to have a common ancestor. They may have some sort of unusual peripheral binding site or a very unusual turn or beta bulge. And so the superfamilies correspond to evolutionary relationships. And they're the evolutionary relationships typically which you could not find using the sequence comparison methods. And so this is certainly the most important level of the SCALP database. The level above that is the fold level. And the fold level brings together proteins which have similarity in their overall structure, but where there is not the compelling evidence of there being an evolutionary relationship. So for example, the TIM barrels, niche glycosyl transferases I was showing you, they look the same when you look at their structures at a high level, that they both have this beta-alpha barrel fold. But we don't see any compelling evidence that they're evolutionarily related. We're not saying that these are not related to each other, but just that we don't see the evidence of that. Maybe sometime later on, there will be evidence of that. And then finally, the folds are grouped together into classes, all alpha, all beta, alpha slash beta, and alpha plus beta. And these classes, to a first approximation, look like just talking about what the secondary structure content is. For example, all alpha is all alpha helix, beta is all beta sheet. These two have a mixture of both alpha helices and beta sheets. And the reason why there's this distinction between alpha slash beta and alpha plus beta is actually kind of interesting. It's a distinction which was made by Levitt and Chothia when they first described these classes about 20 years or 25 years ago now. And what they recognized was that if all proteins had just random mixtures of alpha helices and beta sheets, that then you would expect most proteins to have some of each, and you'd just find a random arrangement of these. So the fact that you actually have proteins with only alpha helices or only beta sheets, it says something very special about protein architecture, that it's much better in some way to make a protein with all alpha helices than to mix alpha helices and beta sheets together, because you find a huge excess of proteins with all alpha helix or all beta sheet. So in addition to finding the all alpha helix and all beta strand as being special characteristics of proteins, things that were highly overrepresented relative to the data available, what you also found was what they called alpha slash beta, which is where you have a beta strand followed by an alpha helix followed by a beta strand that's parallel to it. And you find a huge excess of those. In fact, even today, the population of these classes is roughly equal. And so in this structure, what you have typically is a beta strand, and then I can't actually follow the topology here, but then an alpha helix and another beta strand. And so this is made up of the beta alpha beta proteins. So what sorts of things does one learn from SCOP? Well, one thing that we learned is that most evolutionary relationships are distant. This is looking at all the proteins in the SCOP database with less than 40% identity. It turns out that if you go beyond 40% identity, you get a curve that kind of goes up a little bit and then goes down. But it never actually reaches a peak that's this high. And this axis shows you the number of homologs. This shows you the percentage identity between them. What the outer blocks show you are just what the distribution of things in SCOP are if you try to align them. You can find that most things in SCOP, most of the homologous proteins in SCOP, have levels of identity between 5 and 20%. Most of the homologous proteins have very low levels of sequence similarity. What's shown here in black are the homologs that are detected by S-search, which is a Smith-Waterman implementation, using an E-value cutoff such that you were getting a 1% error rate. And so this was the best pairwise sequence comparison method available at the time I did this analysis. I think it's probably still the best pairwise sequence comparison method available, using all the parameters tuned to make it the best on this database. So if you're using pairwise sequence comparison, this is probably the best that you can do, is getting this tiny fraction of all the homologs, typically those which are more than 20% identical to each other, and not even getting all the ones which are between 25 and 30% identical to each other. So most homologs cannot be found using sequence comparison methods, and you can only find them using structure. Yeah, so using multiple sequence methods definitely improves that greatly. My impression at this point is that if you use a multiple sequence method which starts with a single sequence and iterates outward to build up a family, typically that gets you about 50% more than what the S-search was doing. So it turns out that what S-search is doing here is getting about 18% of all the homologs. If you use iterated SciBlast, then it gets you to about 30% of all the homologs. Basically that's, again, trying to aim for a 1% error rate. If you had databases which you'd made in advance and hand-curated them, like PFAM, you could probably do much better. I mean, PFAM is actually designed to have the SCOP superfamilies in it, and so it explicitly incorporates things which you wouldn't find on your own, but we know from structure are similar, so you can't really evaluate PFAM. I don't know how much you would get covered with PFAM, but I'd expect it would be a lot of this, actually. So PFAM definitely is a much better tool to use than the pairwise sequence comparison for families that are well-characterized. So another thing that the database told us is simply what's in there, because at the time that we started making this database, there are about 1,000 different entries in the protein data bank. If you ask people how many different folds are currently in the protein data bank, the numbers you would get would range between around 50 to around 500. people really had no clue as to how many folds were in there. Even though most people who dealt with structures knew all the structures in there, they just didn't have a good feel for what, actually how to enumerate them. And so building SCOP allowed us to enumerate these. And what we found in the current version of SCOP, which is almost a year old now, we just finished building a new one that's in the process of releasing, that there were 564 folds, 859 superfamilies, 1,368 families. And so there's about 1.5 superfamilies per fold, and about 1.5 families per superfamily. Oh, this is a number I'm going to come back to in a moment. What's that? That's what I showed on the previous slide. So families are groups that are sequence similar to each other, typically. Superfamilies are groups that are homologous to each other, but may or may not have sequence similarity. And folds are groups that are they're structurally similar to each other, but may or may not be evolutionarily related to each other. So probably the number that's most interesting is this one here, the number of different superfamilies. And just to put some context in this, in 1991, there are 160 superfamilies known, and that currently structures are being solved, domains of structures are being solved about 25 times the rate of a decade ago. This is not quite as fast as Moore's Law. If we were going by Moore's Law, you would expect that they're on the order of 70 times as many. But it's not that bad. It is increasing exponentially.
When you can find superfamilies, what are the cutoff sequence similarity and structure similarity? How do you do structure comparison?
So everything in the SCOP database is done by visual inspection. The database is built by visual inspection, so there's no sequence analysis done at all for the superfamily level. And structural similarity also, there's no cutoff in structural similarity, because the structures need to be similar. And that's the first stage. And then the second thing is that there needs to be same superfamily, to be something beyond the structure which also gives evidence that the proteins had a common ester, such as having a similar active site or having a similar kind of peripheral binding site or having unusual turns or unusual bulges. There is one key person who does that, who is Alexei Mersin, who is the only person in the world who is capable of doing that. He is unique. How many proteins per family? I don't know that number off the top of my head. What I can tell you is that in the latest version of SCOP, that there were a total of about 26,000 different domains. So there are about 26,000 different domains. But those domains, they have the level of protein and the level of species in there, and they can be, so you can have Identical proteins would constitute additional domains, as would proteins from different named proteins, but which are sequence similar to each other.
But your families are also defined by domains.
Right? Yes. The family. That's right.
26,000
different domains which belong to each family. But we can't tell how many of those are identical, how many of them are from different proteins, how many of them are from different species. Those numbers do exist, I just don't have them off the top of my head. Actually, I think if you go to the SCOP website, you'll be able to get those numbers. So one thing we realized we could do is we could look at how many superfamilies there are in all of nature by using information from SCOP. And what we would do is we'd look and assume that what we'd seen previous was representative of the world of protein structures, that basically things have been sampled randomly from the universe of protein structures. And in a given year, we'd look at all the new families which were solved that year, so groups which didn't show any sequence similarity to any structure that was known before. We'd see what fraction of those were revealed to have a similar structure to something that was known before, and what fraction really were brand new when the structures were solved, had new folds. And use that fraction, multiply that by the number of superfamilies that existed already, and say this is how big the universe of protein superfamilies is. And so the first year was actually kind of special because the data was collected in a different way. What's really relevant is the data from 1992 to 1995. What you can see is that we estimated in the first year there'd be 570 different superfamilies, the second year we estimated 615, the third year we estimated 724, the third year we estimated 920. So these are still actually kind of interesting numbers. They're relatively modest, on the order of less than 1,000. But what was really happening was the number of new superfamilies was growing faster than the number of known superfamilies. That this number of superfamilies was running away from us. And the reason for that became apparent with a little bit of inspection, because it turns out that I talked before about there being 1.5 superfamilies per fold and 1.5 superfamilies per family. That's the average. The distribution looks like this. Well, this is the whole distribution. But if you truncate this particular bar to make it at a reasonable level, you can see that a small number of folds have evolved independently many different times. For example, the pharidoxin fold appears to have 19 different superfamilies, so may have in principle evolved 19 times independently. The beta alpha barrel fold, what I was showing you before, may have evolved independently 13 different times. But the vast majority of folds only have a single representative amongst them. There's this extremely skewed distribution of superfamilies within folds, and there's a similarly, although not quite as extreme, skewed distribution of families within superfamilies. And again, this is what the whole distribution looks like. So that a small number of superfamilies have diverged into a large number of different families which don't show any sequence similarity to each other. For example, the wing DNA binding domains and the beta alpha hydrolases. But the vast majority of superfamilies which we've seen so far have only evolved into one family. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So why would that suggest to you that maybe your tree root was not right and that they all belong in the same family? Or, I mean, you have 19 branches all doing the same thing. Maybe they're one branch, right?
So the 19 branches I showed you before would be 19 different superfamilies of the same fold, meaning that there were 19 times the structure appeared to have evolved independently.
Right.
So it's possible that they did all have a common ancestor, but in a couple of cases, there's compelling evidence that they didn't. And these are cases where we just don't see any evidence for them having compelling ancestors. For these, I mean, in terms of how many families per superfamily, by sequence comparison, we can't find these as being similar to each other. But the structures make it absolutely obvious that these proteins are homologous to each other, that their backbone structures are virtually identical. The mechanism, the chemistry they're catalyzing is essentially identical. And so, while you could say, okay, I don't believe structure, and I think that all these just evolved independently, all I believe is sequence, I think that the consensus in the community is that these proteins really are evolutionarily related to each other, and it's been predictive, because when you find a new one of these with the same sort of structure, it ends up that it actually catalyzes the same sort of chemistry. And so I'm inclined to believe that this actually represents the way, basically, the history of biology, that this actually describes something about the way biology has occurred.
Your tree is not an evolutionary tree, right?
So no, the tree I'm showing you is not an evolutionary tree. It's a tree which describes these proteins at different levels of information about them. So these upper levels of that tree actually have no evolutionary consequence whatsoever.
You don't really know that it evolved 19 different times. It evolved once, maybe, and then sequence
changed. So we're distinguishing in the SCOP database between those proteins where we can recognize homology from structure and those where we can't. And so for the pharidoxin fold, which was the one where there was 19, we typically cannot say compellingly that these proteins had to have evolved independently 19 times. But for other folds, which have similar characteristics, there is compelling evidence that the fold did evolve independently. And so one can take the view that all proteins with similar structures had a common ancestor. But that view is not very well supported. There is better support for the fact that the proteins did have independent ancestors, although we can't say that all these 19 had independent ancestors.
What would the compelling evidence against?
Basically, sometimes you can see that you can basically see their intermediates, which had to be very different. That basically they converged from some sort of ancestor that was different. And the main evidence that people talk about are beta alpha barrels, where there's some beta alpha barrels where one of the strands is flipped the other direction. And you can actually follow homologous beta alpha barrels where some have had the strand flipped and some haven't, and they appear to have converged to having the strand unflipped.
It seems fold is a more robust measure than superfamily. Superfamily have to guess, are they come from the same evolutionary function or not? But why not just use fold?
So there are two reasons for that. One is that fold doesn't actually necessarily represent anything biological, whereas homology does. Biology is a historical science. We're trying to understand how biology works and how it got to be that way. It's contingent upon the history. And so the evolution tells you something interesting, whereas the structure of a protein typically abstracted does not tell you anything. You never find functional similarity amongst proteins of similar structure unless they were homologous, is basically the observation. And so knowing that proteins are of similar fold really is not a very informative piece of information to have. So that's the first reason for not focusing on fold, because it's not useful. The second reason is that the definition of fold is in many ways even more arbitrary than the definition of superfamily. Because I've been kind of just describing fold as having the same structure. But in fact, folds can be up to 50% different from each other with different elaborations. And so often different methods will disagree on what a fold is. If you look, and in fact, a problem right now is that none of the methods for being able to do structure comparison can reliably tell you whether structures are similar or not. They will rank the structures from most similar to least similar quite effectively, but there's no threshold which you can apply uniformly across a large number of different structures which will actually designate what is a similar fold or not. And so there's no quantitative criteria you can actually really apply very effectively for recognizing folds either. I mean, typically, the recognition of fold requires defining what the core is. The core is defined as the part that's common across many different proteins. And so there's actually a human and circular element involved in that as well. I think the method which has done best at trying to quantitate structural similarity has been the SAP algorithm, which uses a whole lot of quite arbitrary heuristics. The methods which try to be more elegant never have a consistent threshold. And the DALI, for example, sometimes a z-score of 4 is significant, sometimes a z-score of 16 is insignificant. Any other questions? Anyway, so what should be apparent from these Q distributions is that obviously the way we're trying to compute the number of superfamilies in all of nature was not going to provide a reasonable result, because that assumed that basically that family sizes were normally distributed, and that we were looking at a random sampling of protein structures. What we can say, though, from looking at this relatively casually, and what has been actually analyzed more by other groups, including Richard Goldstein, who's here, is that the number of folds which represent the majority of biology in most organisms is still relatively modest, on the order of about 1,000. And the fact that the numbers are relatively small has a lot of very important consequences. One, it means that actually making classifications like this is not something that's going to go on forever, that we actually will come near a conclusion to it, and that there's actually a value in making these classifications. We're not just making classifications which will, you know, end up being in the trillions, and we'd never get to the end point. Secondly, it means that the number is small enough that actually it's possible for a person to understand all of them. That's 1,000 different items is something that a person can actually deal with. If it were 10,000, it would probably be too many for most of us to deal with. It means that when new structures are solved, they're likely to reveal significant evolutionary and functional insights, because they're likely to be homologous to something that's already in the database. If there are about 1,000 major superfamilies, and there are 800 superfamilies known now, of which a significant fraction are amongst those major ones, then it means that when new structures are solved, you have a good chance of it falling into one of those known superfamilies and be able to learn from that. But it also means that pure homology detection is insignificant to guarantee function. In other words, the fact that we found things are evolutionarily related to each other doesn't really tell you anything directly about function. It says that they came from a common ancestor which had one single function, but there's been a huge opportunity for proteins to evolve into different functions today. There are obviously vastly more than 1,000 major different functions in the world today. And so that's what I was talking about actually earlier on, is that homology is not enough to guarantee function. So how do we take this information we've learned about structure and apply it to genomes? Well, as I said before, the problem with genomes is that there's a half of the database, half of the genome, from metazoan organisms, which doesn't show any sequence similarity to anything else which has been experimentally characterized. And so you have two sequences, such as this one here and this one here, which don't show any sequence similarity to each other. The hope is that if we solve the structure of one of these new proteins, that we'll be able to recognize a similarity between that structure and a structure that's already been solved. From the structure, be able to infer homology, and then from that structure infer homology, try to see whether we can make a prediction of function. The idea is that rather than using sequence as a mechanism trying to infer homology, use structure instead, because the structure is better conserved than sequence. The general approach for doing this is what's known as structural genomics, and there are 7 centers in the States, as well as a center in Canada, a center in Europe, and and 2 centers in Japan, which are trying to go through and do what's called structural genomics, and actually go through complete genomes, and for every single protein which is tractable to experimentally study, either have an experimental structure of that protein, or have a homology model which you can build by homologous proteins recognized as being similar from sequence. And the approach is like this. You imagine there being, you know, these proteins spread out in sequence space, where just arbitrarily things that are near each other are similar in sequence, things far from each other are dissimilar in sequence, where a small number of them actually have their structures solved. This would be like the genome for which we want to have all the structures. And so far we have 3 of them. The first thing that's done, and this is what's not talked about very much, most of the time people talk about structural genomics, is you ignore all those proteins which you can't easily get structures for. And so we get rid of all the transmembrane proteins, even though they're very important. We also get rid of all of the unstructured proteins because we can't get structures for them in a reasonable way using the methods that are currently available. And so we just eliminate those and ignore them from these sorts of analyses because those require more detailed efforts. So it's basically based on trying to look at the sequences and trying to guess, and so mainly using low complexity regions, There's been an approach called PONDER, which has been advertised as being a more effective way of looking for unstructured proteins. In our group, we're looking at that, haven't really done much with it yet. It's quite possible that there'll be other unstructured proteins, or probably are unstructured proteins, or at least unstructured without something that they're supposed to bind to, which we won't be able to get structures of. What we're doing is just first eliminating things which we know we wouldn't be able to get structures of. The second thing is then to look beyond the particular gene of interest, the cyan genome, and look at all the homologous genomes, basically all the other proteins that are out there. And this has the advantage of being able to provide us with other proteins of known structure, such as these from magenta genome. And by sequence analysis, look for those which are clearly similar to each other and make families in the canonical sequence analysis way. And then say, because we're able to have these families, we know that since structure is better conserved than sequence over evolutionary time, that if the sequences are significantly similar, they must be homologous. And because they're homologous, they must have similar structures. And therefore, all of these proteins, all these cyan proteins here, will have the same structure in their core as this one. All of these cyan proteins will have the same structure as this one. Likewise for this group, and this group. And so we therefore know we don't need to solve any of the structures of any of the proteins within these groups. Now, I should point out that, for example, this protein here, we probably won't be able to make a very good model structure of. But the main thing we're trying to get by solving the structures in structural genomics is not detailed structural data, which would allow us to, for example, design a drug, but just general structural data, which allows us to be able to recognize homology, which we would not have detected from the sequence analysis. And so since we've detected a homology by the sequence analysis, there's still no need to actually go and solve that structure for the structural genomics projects that are being done in these public groups. It's actually possible to go a step beyond just doing the normal sequence analysis and do things like this, and this is actually what PFAM does as well, is be able to recognize that this structure here and this structure here are homologous to each other using data that's in SCOP because their structures are similar and clearly homologous. And then based on that, build a sequence recognition system based on these sequences and these sequences, such as using hidden Markov models. And then from the hidden Markov model, be able to recognize that a sequence intermediate between the two groups is also a member of that family. And so therefore, all these proteins must be homologous to each other. And therefore, this structure, again, we don't need to solve. Although, again, we probably would not be able to make a high-quality structural model of it, but we'd at least know what the overall fold would be of it. And we wouldn't learn anything about its evolution relationships by solving its structure. Next stage is in prioritizing the families that are left according to what we actually want to do with them. And so there are three types of families one might think about. One are families such as this one here, which are pervasive. Every organism has a representative of these families. We don't know what the structures of any of them are. And typically, we don't know what any of them do. And so these are things where we hope that we can learn a lot of biology about a lot of organisms by solving one structure, whether it be from our model organism or from some other organism. Second case are proteins which are like this one here, which is what's called an orphan, ORFN. It's a term that Danny Fisher coined. These are proteins which don't show any sequence similarity to anything else anywhere. And have you heard about orphans? Have people heard about orphans? Why don't I talk a little bit about orphans? Because I find them really fascinating. When the first genome was sequenced, that of Haemophilus influenza, it had a bunch of these proteins which didn't show any sequence similarity to anything else we've seen before. And this really wasn't a big surprise to most people because they figured, okay, there's some biology we've never seen before, and that's represented in these proteins with no sequence similarity. And the second genome was solved, and that was Mycoplasma genitalium, and it was tiny, and it had some genes which weren't sequence similar to anything else, but that was okay also because it was tiny and it was special, and so it could also have some things which hadn't been seen before. But now with about 30 microbial genomes sequenced and several larger genomes sequenced, there's still, in every single genome, with the exception of Mycoplasma genitalium, a large number of these genes with no sequence similarity to anything else at all. And no one really knows what these are. One possibility is they're just not genes, that they're things which look like genes to the gene finders, but they're just mispredictions, and they don't really do anything. They're not interesting biologically. A second possibility is that they are genes, and they really are brand new genes that are unique to that particular organism, or at least unique to that organism with respect to all the organisms that are out there, that they're very recently evolved. That violated most people's assumption that mainly you have descent with variation as opposed to having these brand new genes being created. So there's the question of where are these genes coming from and why is our model of there being descent with variation fundamentally wrong. The third possibility is that these are genes which actually are homologous to other proteins. They actually do belong to some larger family which we have representatives of. But we have never been able, but for some reason this particular gene has been evolving unusually rapidly and therefore we can't recognize it using sequence similarity. At this point, we don't know which of the three cases is actually true, and I consider figuring out what the nature of these orphans is to be one of the most interesting things before us in terms of evolution of complete genomes. Is where are these orphans coming from and what are they? Yes? Are they?
Well,
I mean, in human,
case, but lots of them. I
mean, in humans, there are. But how about
these? They get expressed. You look at people, they get expressed. I mean, I don't know about every single one, but certainly lots of them do. But see, I think so. When you said they don't show sequence similarity, or anything, I think that's a stretch because when people are trying to do the genome annotations, you have to pick some threshold of what you think is a significant gap, right? And they pick that threshold such that they're going to have very few false positives. Well, I could lower that sequence, I could lower that threshold so that I know I'm going to get some false positives, but I might still have 95% true positives. So that would say, if I lower my threshold such that, let's say, I get 5% false positives, that means I'm going to predict a whole bunch of new genes that can belong to certain functions. 5% of those predictions are wrong. I don't know which 5%, but 95% of the time I'm going to be right. And I'm going to say, so I have assigned a function to something. Just that it's not very reliable.
So I don't have it in this talk, but I can show you a slide where we've tested whether you can actually do that. And it turns out that you can't get to the, you might be able to get to the point where you're getting 95% true positive, but you can't get to the point where you're finding 95% of all of the homologs. Because you end up having you get deluged with false positives. And so you can lower your thresholds, and people have done that. Even when you lower your thresholds, you still find a large number of orphans.
Still find, right? But you can reduce the number a lot. So the number of I don't know, it's 25-30%. You can probably reduce that to
10%
or something. You can reduce it a lot by
a certain
fraction of false positives. So I don't know. I think your last option is the one that's most likely. These are not unique things anymore. They really are homologs. They evolve fast enough that it's hard to recognize what the homolog is, but they're undoubtedly homologous to something. And a combination of the sensitivity of the methods and the rate of evolution makes it hard to decide exactly what the homology is.
So I share your bias that that's what their actual history is. But it's also possible to imagine a model whereby there's some huge turnover of creating new genes and them not being fixed in the population. And so what we're seeing in the orphans could be, you can imagine, some huge froth of trial genes that end up failing and therefore never get fixed. But there's always, in current living organisms, a huge number of new genes out there. And so I think that the middle model is also possible. And some people have given evidence for why that would be more likely. I can't tell you off the top of my head what it is. I didn't find it as compelling as the suggestion that these actually are homologous, to other proteins. I don't think that actually by changing the thresholds of the methods, you actually can get it down from 20% to 10%. The fraction is actually now, for most bacteria, less than 20%. That are orphans. It's about 20 to 25% which belong to any of the unknown categories, and the orphans are typically now the smallest category of those.
But that's partly because there's so many bacteria that most of them have a pretty close homolog. So, between E. coli and Salmonella, there are a few orphans, but we may not know what they do. I think pretty much have 80% the same proteins in them.
But there's still orphans that are left in E. coli, and
right.
And you can't get rid of half of them by changing your parameters. You might be able to get rid of a third of them, but I don't know what the exact fractions are. But we've tried that, and even if you're very permissive, you don't get rid of most of them. And then the third category, just to finish up here, are proteins which are common to proteins, for example, E. coli and Salmonella, which are unique to some clade of organisms, but which we don't see sequence similarity to other organisms. And again, it may be that these are truly unique to these organisms, are represent the slow creation of new proteins over evolutionary time. Or it may be that these also are homologous to something that's more distant, and the fact that we just see it between these two organisms is because their ancestor had a rapidly evolving protein at that point. So that's actually not completely true. An unusually large fraction of the orphans, for example, have homopolymeric regions, which appear to have essentially risen de novo. I mean, there may have been one serine and expanded into 100 serines, and that made a protein. And so you could say, okay, it really was related to this one serine and some different protein. But there's not really a useful relationship between the two. We have no idea where new protein structures come from, because basically wherever we find two proteins which have which are homologous, they have similar structures. We never find we don't have a way of knowing where new structures come from, so there's really no data about that. So if these were truly new, we don't know what the mechanism by which they're created would be, and perhaps if they are truly new, that will give us something to begin to look at, because we can look and see what closely related organisms to the organisms that have the orphans are like in that same region of the genome, and see if we can understand where this new protein came from. So, yeah, we don't have a good model for what new protein where new proteins come from. Now, Gary, do you know of anyone who has a good model for where new proteins come from, or how proteins are created?
Besides exon swapping, if exon was much smaller than domain, you could get a whole impression by exon swapping. But it also occurs to me that maybe you duplicate a gene and then one copy of it actually gets transcribed in a long strand. It turns out that just by chance, because of codon bias, you can
right.
Long over the protein in the opposite strand. And so that's a source of new protein. And I don't know of any examples like that, but I wouldn't be surprised if you could get a new protein by reading the long strand.
And Gene Shapiro's speculating that transposons.
I mean that shuffles typically domains around. And there's people have been looking for years to find evidence of exons smaller than domains causing new proteins, and no one's been able to actually demonstrate anything so far. And so, while it's possible at this point, the evidence for that is not strong. Given how many people try to find it, I think that's probably unlikely. But that's a bias rather than anything which there's real data for. Possible. Bacteria tend not to have as many repeats, and eukaryotes that would make more sense. Anyway, there aren't good models for where new proteins come from that people have proven to be verifiably true, and so we don't have a good model for what these would be if they were new proteins or how they would have come to be there. And so if they are new proteins, that would actually be something which might give us a way of asking that question. So within the families we choose to solve, so for example, looking at this family first, because it's one of these pervasive families, we actually typically don't actually solve the structure of the protein which is from the organism we actually are studying, in this case, Mycoplasma genitalium. Instead, most often, the groups will solve structures of proteins which are more tractable to study. And in practice, that means studying proteins from hyperthermophiles. The reason being that hyperthermophilic proteins are easier to purify. And it appears that one of the main problems people have in crystallography is getting crystals. But the problem with getting crystals turns out to actually be a problem getting pure protein in a great many cases. And so by using hyperthermophilic proteins that are easier to purify, you greatly increase your chance of getting crystals and getting results. And so in the center, we actually have a Berkeley. This is what we're starting with, is 677 proteins from Mycoplasma pneumonia. 254 of these match a protein of known structure over any portion of the protein. This is using very permissive ways of doing the analysis. 188 of these proteins are membrane. The ones with single transmembrane paths eventually we'll engineer out and do the domains that are soluble on either side of the transmembrane domain. And probably also for the two transmembranes, the ones with more than two transmembrane helices we're pretty much going to ignore. And that leaves us with 283 remaining candidate proteins. 115 of those have homologs in any other organism. 95 of them have homologs in thermophilic organisms, so those are going to be the first things to actually be gone after. 168, which are unique to Mycoplasma pneumonia and Mycoplasma genitalium, which even if you use permissive sequence comparison methods, you don't find any homologs to. 45 of those have no UGA coding for tryptophan. So an unusual thing about the mycoplasmas is that the UGA codon codes for tryptophan, whereas in most other organisms, including E. coli, where we actually express the proteins, it codes for a stop codon. And so if you have these tryptophan codons represented by UGA, and you try to express them in E. coli, you don't get your protein expressed. You get part of your protein expressed up to where that tryptophan should exist. So there are 45 of these 168 which exist without UGA. There are 38 which have one UGA, which is fairly easy to engineer out. And then there are 23 with two UGAs and 52 with greater than two UGAs. And these are going to pose a problem because engineering out more than one or two UGAs is a bit of experimental effort, which is greater than what we wanted to invest. So this is actually what. So there's been a lot of work trying to put in the suppressor tRNAs, and you can get some low-level expression, but apparently it's extremely difficult to get enough to make it useful for crystallography. And so at this point, the main focus has been on engineering them out. the groups have trying to use these suppressors, and you do get some expression, but it's not very good.
Usually, there might be a couple of temperature-sensitive termination factors. I'm sure they thought of the same idea.
Yeah, they've worked pretty hard at it, and I think the problem is mainly that I think the cells are just really sick because they're transcribing way past all their normal stop codons.
Do it in the case where you turn this on while the cells are dying, you make as much protein as you can just before they die, or something like that.
I guess the other
people do that already. There's a lot of these cell synthesis things where they turn on a real high level of some protein, and they know mm-hmm. the cells are going to die within an hour, but they can make so much protein in an hour that they get what they want.
You see, the impression I have is that you still get a fair amount of termination at the UGAs, and so then you get full-length protein and partial-length protein, which increases your purification problem. And it's a problem that's solvable because there are different lengths, but it complicates matters. And so the suppressor thing was the thing that was tried first in the center, and eventually they kind of gave up on that, or at least have put that on the back burner, and the idea of engineering them out has become the preference, because that ends up just being a fairly clean solution. You know what's happening. And so the hope is that we'll see something like what I described before, is that when we solve, for example, the structure here from a hyperthermophile, that we'll be able to see that that structure is both structurally similar, and by looking at it carefully, be able to infer homology to another protein, for example, this one here of known structure, and from that be able to unify these two families into a single superfamily, and from that be able to make some hypothesis as to what the function of this would be. And so what I'm showing you here is the ATP binding subunit of the ABC transporters. And this is probably the paragon of a structural genomics protein, because the ABC transporters are the largest family of proteins in just about all the microbial genomes that have been sequenced. And in total, there are about 2,000, or actually more than that now, in such proteins in the protein data bank. And this one structure allows us to make, at least at a very low resolution, poor quality, models of what all the other ATP binding subunits of these ABC transporters look like, including, for example, this one here, where this is the protein CFTR, the cystic fibrosis transporter protein, the chloride transporter. And deletion of this particular residue here is what ends up being the causative reason of getting cystic fibrosis. Deletion of this residue here is the greatest source of single-point genetic disease in Caucasians. And so we're hoping that by studying the structure, we'll be able to understand something about the mechanism by which the protein misfolds and aggregates and therefore does not allow proper chloride transport. This is probably a more typical case of protein. This is a picture of eukaryotic translation initiation factor 5A. As the name implies, something was known about its function prior to the structure being solved. Its general role in being involved in translation was known already. Its molecular role in the translation was entirely unknown at the time the structure was solved. And what they were able to see from the structure was that it had an RNA binding domain, and that RNA binding domain has led them to go on to additional experiments to try to understand the molecular role of this particular protein. And I think that's typical, the type of level of information that one will get out of structural genomics. It's not going to tell you in a very detailed way what the function is, but it will give you clues which you can then use to go into further experiments to understand what the function might be. And so in some ways it was a triumph for structural genomics because the structure did give insight into the function. It was also a tragedy for structural genomics, and the reason for that is that this structure was solved by Tom Terwilliger's group thinking that no one else would ever solve the structure of eukaryotic translation initiation factor 5A because it wasn't really a very interesting protein, but was a good protein to just go after if you just want to solve lots of structures to learn new things. Well, Sung-ho Kim had the same idea, and both groups independently solved the same not terribly interesting structure. Something even worse happened at the first structural genomics meeting now about 3 years ago that was held in Chicago. Sung-ho Kim had solved the structure of a fibrillin protein, which he thought was interesting because it was involved in a human disease, in which first the molecular function was entirely unknown. Solving the structure revealed that it was an RNA methyltransferase, or at least strongly suggested it was an RNA methyltransferase, and gave some ideas to what its function might be and how it actually might lead to this disease. After he gave his talk, Eugene Koonin raised his hand and was called on and said, "I'm really excited to hear that's an RNA methyltransferase, because I actually predicted it was an RNA methyltransferase and published that prior to your ever doing these experiments." So I was kind of shocked to hear this because Sung-ho Kim is a very good scientist. I didn't think that he would go and do an experiment which was totally unnecessary. And so I went to the literature to find out whether Koonin had actually made this prediction or whether he'd somehow bungled it in some way or whether he was just going beyond what he'd really done. And so I went to the literature and searched around for papers by Kunin, and which talk about methyltransferases, about the fibrillin proteins and methyltransferases, couldn't find anything. So I wrote to Eugene Kunin and said, where did you publish this? I can't find it, even knowing that you published it. And so he pointed me to this reference here. I looked at it, and sure enough, there was, in boldface no less, the prediction, fibrillarins are predicted to be rRNA methyltransferases. He'd said it as clearly as day. He hadn't actually made a structural model, but he predicted what the molecular function was, and basically through the process of predicting what their structure was. The thing is, he didn't make any comment about what the structure was, or even that this protein was of interest to him, anywhere in the title or anywhere in the abstract. And so the only way that anyone would ever known that Eugene had made this prediction is if they'd happened to read his paper about E. coli proteins, and somehow came thinking of this as a human disease protein, and therefore didn't think to read a paper about E. coli proteins, or if they'd done a managed to do some sort of full text search of the literature, which back at this time was not a feasible option. And so I think this shows is that there's actually a lot of interesting biology going on that's being buried in the literature. One of the things that we've done at Berkeley is built a database called Presage, which tries to take these structural predictions people have made and archive them. But I think what more this more generally shows is the importance of having a database of literature which is possible to search through, and not just the title and abstract. And so finally, what do we actually expect to learn from these structural genomics efforts? Well, what I'm showing you up here on this upper graph is just the number of structures that are solved per year, actually the number of domains solved per year, from 1987 to 1997, although data for 1997 is partial, and that was when this particular analysis was done. And what you can see is that the number of structures solved has actually increased. This is where the 25-fold increase comes from this time here. This is not a cumulative graph. This is per year. There's been a tremendous growth in the amount of structural biology going on worldwide. What's remarkable is that if you look at what people are actually doing when they solve these structures, this remained incredibly constant even as there's been this huge growth in the number of structures solved. That basically half of the structures solved over the whole time, where this section down here, are proteins which are essentially identical to proteins which are already in the protein data bank. And so these structures are being solved because they're solved under a different condition, or by a different group, or with a different ligand, or with a small mutation. And so these are being solved to get very detailed information. Now, the fact that these account for half structures does not mean they account for half the effort, that probably they account for a much smaller fraction of the effort, because such structures are much easier to solve than totally new structures. Nonetheless, I think that the constancy of this fraction over that time is really remarkable. These two fractions here refer to groups of proteins which are different from proteins that were already in the protein data bank, but which you could have recognized as structure. What's that? That may explain it. The next large batch, that would suggest, though, that 85% of the PhD students never get the first 2 years of new structure solved, which is also a disturbing fact. The next two sets here that I'm showing here are proteins which you could have recognized as being homologous to protein in the protein data bank using fairly straightforward sequence analysis methods. And that presumably these, again, were solved to get very detailed information, for example, to know how the protein folds, understand how there's variation between different organisms, or to understand how you might, for example, make an inhibitor for drug design. What it means, though, it's only about 15% in the recent years, a slightly larger fraction longer ago, of the proteins which people were studying which had no sequence similar to anything in the protein data bank, where they actually had the potential to see something that was entirely new. In stark contrast to the uniformity of what we see in this graph is what's happened amongst those proteins in that top section, those proteins which look unlike anything that's in the current protein data bank at the sequence level. 10 years ago, if you solved one of those structures, you were pretty much guaranteed you're going to get a new fold. And that's something you could put on the cover of Nature. And so you had a large incentive for going after one of those and trying to get its structure. Today, only about a quarter of those structures have a new fold. And this fraction is decreasing. And about another quarter of those proteins are proteins which have a fold that's been seen before, but cannot be recognized as being homologous to another protein in the protein data bank. So in some ways, this is kind of the worst category to be in, because you haven't got a new fold, you haven't seen anything really new and exciting, but also you haven't learned anything about the function of it or its evolutionary history, because it's not homologous to anything you've seen before. And so you kind of have a structure that doesn't really do very much for you. And then this category here is either the most exciting or the least exciting category, depending upon your point of view, where you are able to find an evolutionary relationship from the structure. It's least exciting because it means that what you found is something which was homologous to something already in the protein data bank, and therefore isn't new in any interesting way at all. But it means that it's most powerful for understanding the biology of it, because now you have this evolutionary relationship which you can then try to make some inference of function. And so this is what's happening today with such proteins, actually in 1997, that half of those proteins end up being homologous to proteins that were in the protein data bank. And we expect that that's what will happen in structural genomics as new structures are solved. So that if we go through it, the half of the genome for which the structures are currently unknown, that in roughly half those cases we'll be able to find a homology and be able to say something, we hope, about what the function is. So the picture we hope to create through structural genomics is something like this, where there's some, again, still relatively small fraction that's been experimentally studied to understand the biology, where there's a growing fraction where there's function by homology, and hopefully this will continue to grow using addressing the types of problems I set before you earlier, and hopefully, especially, I think it will grow more reliable. And then amongst these mysteries, I hope that structures will help us give some clue and be able to put these into the category of function by homology, but function by homology inferred from structure rather than from sequence. And so I also just want to mention some of the other folks who were involved in this sort of research. There's my group at Berkeley. Well, most of the work I talked about actually was done while I was working with Michael Levitt and work done with Sung Ho Kim and Igor Grigoryev at the Berkeley Center for Structural Genomics, as well as Alexei Mersin, Cyrus Chothia, Tim Hubbard, and Loredana Locante involved in the SCOP database. Thanks very much. What's that? This actually was what was immediately outside the door to my lab. We moved, but in the original place where our lab was located, this was right outside our door. That's right. Thank you.